Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bowne. Now, last month, you might remember that I was joined around the table by the writer brothers Will and Tom Hodgkinson to discuss something old and something new that's piqued their interest or has influenced them recently. And today, we're going to kick it off all over again. This time, I've invited in a rather fantastic autistic duo. Francesca Gavin is a regular voice on Monocle 24, for those of you who tune into our arts review. She's an art writer, editor and curator, working with titles such as Another Magazine and Twin, and casting a curatorial eye over events like the Travelling Art by Biennial Manifesto, no less. And Shauna Gavin is Francesca's sister. She's a London-based artist and a dab hand at turning something old into something new herself. Her bright and bold collages have been hung on both sides of the Atlantic and published in plenty of magazines too. The Gavin sisters are in the house. Welcome both.
You're in a Gavwidge. It's an official thing.
A Gavwidge.
Yeah.
I like it. Gavin versus Gavin. Gavin on Gavin.
Exactly.
Gavin squared.
Double Gavin.
Double Gavin. It's a double Gavin.
Yeah.
So Shauna, you're the new voice to Monocle 24's Listening Several.
Very happy to be here.
It's nice to have you here. Welcome to the gang. And first of all, you're going to trot out your something old for us.
Yeah.
So you've been rootling around in secondhand bookshops, charity shops, all of the about.
Yes, you know, as my work is, I use old photographic imagery to create my kind of collage environments.
Yeah.
So I become more and more, I mean, every time I walk past the secondhand bookshop or a charity shop, I kind of have to go in just in case there's something there that I need to find. I'm lucky that I have, there's an old bookshop near where I live, which I regularly visit.
A good source.
Yes, a very good source. And they have a lot of, especially visual books, you know, more than writing, obviously, because I'm an artist. So I went in there recently. This was about a week ago. And I saw they had a few crates of new books that I hadn't seen before. And a lot of them were like clearly, you know, my interest. There was a lot of Hieronymus Bosch and amazing kind of photography books and, you know, stuff like African tribal masks and things like that.
Yeah, so and people, if they're not familiar with your work, will be looking it up, I'm sure, as they're listening to this show. There is something of that crazy sort of happenstance of there's Hieronymus Bosch, there's a lot of mosaic and collage, and there's a bit of Peter Blake kind of...
Yeah,
you know
kind of
what
surreal
I mean?
Kind of...
Yeah.
I describe my work as kind of surreal... Well, it has surreal psychedelic science fiction overtones, so it's kind of quite otherworldly. But I kind of like to mix in lots of references from ancient civilizations and, but kind of combined with
a
ideas
of natural history. And it looks a bit like the Ray Harryhausen kind of monsters that were in all those kind of 60s things about ancient Greece. Those kind of like heroic myths.
And exactly. Things. I loved all those films. Yeah. So yeah, that's definitely an influence. But yeah, I came across all these books and I was speaking to the guy in the shop and he said that they just had a whole new delivery from, turns out, was part of the personal collection of Wolfgang Soschitzky, which was quite well-known photographer, cinematographer, who was originally from Vienna, that emigrated to London during the 1930s, I guess escaping war or whatever.
And his stuff is amazing. And he's one of these photographers, legend photographer. He died when he was 104. He's got some good genes, right?
Exactly.
Soschitzky genes, good genes.
Strong Jewish genes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And his stuff is the stuff of legend. His pictures kind of chronicle England in London and England in the 40s, this kind of working class, kind of beautiful kind
of background. Yeah, really nice. And I mean, I'd obviously seen his work, but when he said the name, I didn't like immediately remember like what he was associated with. But the guy was like explaining to me that it was his son that had sold a chunk of the books recently, and I wrote the name down because I was really interested, so I wanted to like look it up afterwards. And obviously, I mentioned it to Fran, and she was like, "Oh, it's him." And then I sort of started to research a bit more about
That's
him
where
the and
what he thing comes
what he'd done.
In,
yeah, of course. But the really special thing is that I couldn't help it. I ended up buying a few of these books, and you know, usually I'm looking more for material for my artwork, but in this case, these are books to keep. And that often, that's happening more and more. So, yeah, more and more my bookshelves at home are like being overtaken.
We both have
so
a
fewer things
we
have got holes in. Okay.
Got a bit of a book addiction, book addiction at the moment.
But what are you and how do you know? Have you got the number of a good builder? Are you planning an extension? This is what you need, right? This is what happens to people. They're like,
I think eventually that.
Do that we need that loft?
Yeah.
Full of suitcases? Yeah.
Yeah, they take up a lot of space. What was really special is there was a book, a 1950s photography book on Angkor in Thailand. Really beautiful black and white photos. And what was really nice is that inside lots of the pages were like tear sheets and articles and leaflets that he'd put in there himself, like on the subject. And it just really felt like a really personal thing. It felt like I was like discovering his like his own personal scrapbook or something.
And it's a wonderful thing as well when someone is famous for their photography, their cinema photography, they are like you, a visual person. Mm. You get to know their handwriting and their turns of phrase and their abbreviations for people or things or just the way their mind works.
Yeah, it was really, it felt really like a bit of an insight into his mind. And there was another one which was a photography book, and actually there was little scraps of paper that he had put in with the, you know, talking about like camera types of cameras or like film that he used or things like that that were like placed in, you know, maybe for his reference or something. So yeah, it just felt like a really I felt very privileged.
And do you feel that this kind of, you said you and Fran both have a book addiction? It's one of the better ones. Let's face it.
It's not a bad addiction.
It's a big addiction, though.
Is it?
Yes, majorly. I have a serious problem whenever I go out.
Are you partners in crime in this?
We both have different variations of the art books that we go for. Yeah. But we both do go for visual books. But I can see books immediately and go, "That has Shauna written all over it." But the minute she found this crop of books, she phoned me up. I was actually in New York going, "Fran, I found these amazing books at the old bookshop." And there's something kind of, we both have like visual problems, but I always think of it as like my future pension.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I'm hoping.
Yeah.
I like the way I've bought these amazing books. What do you think about them? And you go, Shostaki, you say.
Well, I'd actually curated some of his work for a private collection for someone, but I'm obsessed with his work from around Charing Cross Road, which is another book-centric location.
And of course, book central,
Yeah, so we had taken pictures of like the old foils, and it's, I don't know, we're like third generation Londoners. And so our grandfather probably arrived like a little before him.
Yeah.
So it's a real sense of the history of the city as well. I don't know. I think that's really super exciting.
It's an amazing thing. There's obviously a little bit of you tied up in there, or similar stories you tied up in Sosiecki's work and his life, and possibly his notes in the margin, very excitingly as well. As an artist, Shauna, do you feel that you are absorbing this? Do you feel you're absorbing this stuff as a fan or as someone that's interested in his story and his work? Or can you almost feel the drip, drip, drip of the ideas melting into your work at a later date?
It actually kind of inspired me to create, especially with that particular book that on Angkor, like, because I've always loved, I mean, whenever I've seen images of that place, it's always really intrigued me and it looks amazing and somewhere I'd like to go one day. So it kind of maybe inspired a potential future series of works, you know, as a kind of homage to him, and maybe like an exhibition where I can, you know, include some of these clippings. And I mean, it just became aware from his book collection that me and him had quite some overlapping kind of similar tastes and things.
Right.
Because I think he's interested in anthropology and people from all over the world. And so that's, you know, sometimes that those references, you know, appear in my work.
It's beautiful stuff. It's a wonderful story, wonderfully told. We won't give your local bookshop name away.
I think that's a gem you want to keep
hidden,
yes,
right?
Yes, I want to keep that as a secret, definitely.
Normally when I say that, people go, no, it's on the corner of wherever it is.
It's a very formative bookshop for both of us. I mean, I've been going there since I was 11. I used to go there every day after school and like go through the shelves and buy things. I think it's amazing when you have a relationship, particularly with a secondhand bookshop. It kind of forms you. So it's a special place.
There's a book in that in itself, right? I want to see both your names on the cover of that. Shauna talked to us there about Wolfgang Sosiecki, falling in love with a man's work through generations. It's a wonderful story, beautifully told. Francesca, we're going to turn to you now. We're going to stay on the old track. Now we're going back to Venice in the 16th century, I think, aren't we? We're going to Bronzino. Tell us about what you've brought in.
It's really interesting. I was thinking, like, what is one of my favourite older things? And it's this painting, which is Venus's, well, it's an allegory of Venus and Cupid by Bronzino that hangs in the National Gallery in London. And it's painted in 1546. I did my A-level dissertation on it. Most people will know it because it contains the foot from the Monty Python animations by Terry Gilliam.
That's where it comes from.
If you look at the bottom left of the painting, just on a pillow of Cupid's lower right leg, you will see it is the Monty Python foot. But for me, there's so many reasons why I like this painting.
I've always thought that foot belonged to a stouter fellow than Bronzino's Cupid.
Yes, he's quite pert. Particularly in the cheek bum department.
He's very, he's a well-developed young man there.
Well, there's so many reasons why I love this painting. And they're interesting, the version you've done is the unrestored version where she's covered and his bum's covered, and those things have actually been revealed since. At first you look at it and it's totally allegorical. It's like time revealing the fact that Venus is stealing Cupid's bow and therefore he'll lose all his powers. So we have all these strange items around it, an empty mask, tragedy in the top left corner holding his head going, oh no, it's all going to go wrong, a strange dove. It's like weird, mysterious stuff. But on researching it, and it's like one of those paintings that have so many different layers to it. So, for example, one of them, it was given by the Medicis to Francis I of France as a gift. And you think, well, why are rival royal families giving a gift? But then it also turned out that Francis I was dying of syphilis. And it was actually a way of the Italians going, haha, we're making fun of you. You're dying for your sexual pleasures. So I loved, this was the first painting that I became aware that you could look at objects and see not only the surface of how it's painted technically, not only the political elements within it, not only the like emotional side, the idea that an artwork could have so many different layers beyond a simple thing.
Yeah.
And it kind of probably inspired me to continue doing what I do.
Well, that's fascinating stuff. So you know, we know this, you know, in the art market trade, especially in the auction trade, looking at the back of the people are more fascinated by the back of the painting than the front of the painting. People want to know what the provenance of this work is. That's amazing stuff to know that it was given as a almost like the Dauphin giving the young Henry V in Shakespeare's play tennis balls. Right, as a very highfalutin diss.
Well, going to that amount of effort that you could create something that's basically like your penis is rotting and you're ill.
Yes, exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
But also, I do hope they take that quote out of context and use it on the website.
but also layered with that. I mean, I think mannerism is a really interesting period as well. I think it's really contemporary in a way. It's often about surface. This is like the very end of the Renaissance, post Michelangelo. Like you've got like Andrea del Sarto and then Pontormo, who's coming in. It's in Pontormo taught Bronzino. And it's very much this sort of like really glossy, surface-led, like look how technically capable we are with painting.
And this was one of the things, one of the criticisms that's levelled against Bronzino. Not my criticisms, Francesca Gavin. Far be it from me. But that he's sort of technically perfect, a bit lacking in emotion. He was a contemporary of Titian and Tintoretto, rather. These kind of people that maybe kind of had a bit more chutzpah. This man is a technical genius.
Well, it's very cold. Yeah, you know, the style's cold. The paint is polished and cold. Very different from like the Titian fleshiness of like the Venetian stuff of that period. This was much more like technical clean, but I find it weirder. I like the weirdness of it. If you actually look at the paintings, they're very odd.
There is a bit of, I mean, we're going almost back to some of that, the sort of Dutch masters. We're going back to that kind of ultra hyper reality that Shauna was talking about of Hieronymus Bosch, actually, where it's all a bit too real, despite the subject matter.
Quite intense.
Actually, the detail is right in your face.
Well,
no wonder they covered up his bum and her.
Yeah, and her bits.
Her bits.
But also, I like going around the National Gallery and looking at it in different ways. Like, one of my favourite things is to go around and just look at portraiture with black backgrounds.
Yeah.
And if you've got this hundreds of portraits of people with black backgrounds, and it's such a strange thing. Or you could go around a museum and look at it with like, I'm just going to look at people's hands. And then just seeing how someone reinterprets the same thing in different ways, I think is a really fascinating way of taking something very familiar and making something really new and interesting out of it. And maybe that's what the process of curation is, in a sense. Mm. How do you take things that we all have, that we all see, and kind of reconfigure it for different contexts, for different people, for different views? So this is something I did during my A-level, this was my A-level dissertation, but I would, you know, I've continued to make art, to curate and write about art since.
So this is great. I love the fact that this is the creation myth for your career.
And what a weird beginning. Also, they've done such strange things to the bodies. The body's so twisted. Yeah, isn't it? Isn't it funny?
Yeah, it is. It's an odd one. Can you remember the first time you saw this painting at the National Gallery here in London, Francesca?
Yeah.
Did you like it? I mean, it sounds like a stupid thing to say. Andy Warhol said art is about liking things. Did you like this painting? Did you walk away with a postcard at that young age? Was it something that kept on drawing you back and you wondered why you were so curious?
Well, it's really interesting being here with my sister while we're talking about this, because at the age of nine, when I was nine and Sean was seven, our mother, who had been to St. Martin's, gave us her art postcard collection. Uh-huh. And from that age, we were exchanging and swapping and building huge collections of art postcards. So without a doubt, that's where our interest in art and definitely the history of art came. So I would have seen this painting for the first time when I was 11. I think maybe 10, no, most likely 11. I remember it more then. It wouldn't have been what I was the most into at that time. We've gone through different stages. We were very into like Wallace Collection, 18th century, Boucher bellies. Yeah. We used to call Boucher and Fragonard. Yeah. Yeah.
Which now we probably find quite boring.
Yeah. And then I went through a massive Pre-Raphaelite stage because it had curly hair and there's nothing else with curly
teenage
hair.
Teenage girls go very poetic and romantic.
Yeah, exactly. You were more Ophelia in my mind. So, and then it sort of transforms. There are different things. So the Bronzino was probably something I got into later. I probably didn't get it earlier. You know, it wouldn't have appealed to me. I didn't like things as weird when I first saw it.
Yeah, and I suppose there's that challenge to a young mind or a blossoming young mind as well, as it figures out what it wants to talk about in later life. It's kind of there is a bit of a puzzle. There is the joy of liking liking something old.
Well, and when
you're young,
of it.
Yeah, and it's not unsexy.
No, it's a pretty sexy
despite
painting.
Despite the Monty Python first.
Yes,
it's amazing. So, and is it one of those things? I love the idea of walking around the National Gallery and just looking at specific
one thing. Yeah.
Things, the backgrounds or the hands or the rest of it. This is very quick. Just before we move on to Shauna's new selection for this part of the programme, who are the best? Because wasn't Da Vinci's sort of Achilles heel was his inability to draw hands very well. What is it? Who's good hands? Who's bad hands?
But I love it when they get it wrong and make it weird. I mean, Cranach, he's the strangest necks I've ever seen. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, there are like, when they get it wrong, they're at their best.
Yeah.
In a weird way.
There's
it's almost like
humble
you look
and human
at it
about it.
Going, oh, how strange is that? Yeah. I like the really early Renaissance stuff where everything's wrong. You know, or the compositions are wrong.
Before they'd learnt like perspective.
Exactly, pre-perspectival.
I like it. Mm. Pre-perspectival. Yes. We managed to go from rotting penises to pre-perspectival. While talking about Bronzino, Francesca, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Shauna's going to pick something new out of the hat, and that is Super Collider.
Yes.
So fill our listeners in who might not. Now, I know of this, and I know of some of the work that they do, but fill our listeners in on exactly who these guys are and your role in it.
Okay, so they're not brand new because they're actually founded, they have just had their 10-year anniversary. It was founded by Chris Hatherall. So they're basically an independent agency that are based in London and Hong Kong, and they work to bring together science with the creative industries. So they put on loads of really interesting talks and events and parties and exhibitions, all kind of bringing together those themes. Like they did a couple of years ago an exhibition which was all sort of art and photography inspired by the moon. And maybe the moon landing and things like that. And then they do these like trips away for small groups, like field trips where they like go to the
field trip.
Yeah.
Do you know that?
Like a school trip.
No,
like a school trip.
Got your compass.
Yeah.
Got your little
isn't
rucksack?
The Venice Biennale a big school
that
trip?
That is
for
a big
all
school
us?
Trip, I know.
But yeah, I unfortunately haven't been on any yet. But
you haven't been on any field trips?
No, I want
Shauna.
Well, not their field trips. Okay. Obviously I have in my life, but not for a long time. But yeah, they do things like they get a group of people to go to Iceland to view the Northern Lights and then I think they're doing one next year where they're going somewhere maybe to view the solar eclipse, wherever it's going to be in America. So, yeah, and I mean, I have a lot of sort of spacey astronomy sort of references in my work. So yeah, I love, you know, they're always like ahead of the game, knowing when the next, you know, meteor shower is going to happen or so it's...
The next supermoon.
Yeah, exactly. They're always on top of those things.
Does it feel like fertile ground for artists? Does something come out of all these things? Is it more of a social thing or is it as much, does art come out of it at the end of the day as well?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think what their approach is that science can have a very more of a nerdy, straight kind of, you know, when you think about what science actually is, it's actually quite rigid and can be sort of not so inspiring, you know, so visual. But I think their approach is to kind of bring it a more kind of pop, fun aspect to science.
Because so it's one of those things as well, because I think a lot of artists are fascinated by science and fascinated by a lot of the methodology and a lot of the materials as well, the materiality of it. I mean, the Wellcome Trust just down the road from us here, the Wellcome Collection.
The Wellcome Collection, I
just
love it.
Down
I was there,
it's such a good place for exhibitions.
2 days ago.
Yeah, it must be one of the most reliable places in London to
good
see a great exhibition.
Too.
Yeah.
Relax with the bookshops, Francesca.
Sorry.
But it's one of those things. I wonder what is it in your mind? What is it in the artistic imagination that is so led towards science? Where so many people that work on the periphery of the arts perhaps kind of have not a snooty attitude to it, but feel that it is too far removed from the world of the everyday somehow. What captures your imagination about it?
I've always loved nature. I think with me personally, maybe it stems from my kind of appreciation of science fiction more than science, so much science. Part of one of the things that inspired me to first start creating the work I do is... it carries on from the book obsession, which actually began with our parents' books, a book obsession that we were surrounded with as children. My dad collected a lot of sci-fi novels and sort of 60s visionary books. And I was age five, I was obsessed with looking through these. So I think it was that kind of began my interest in what's beyond Earth and space and life on other planets and all those kind of ideas.
How good were those book covers, by the way? Those science fiction.
Oh, yeah.
We all had like the octopus sort of science fiction omnibus. We all had those kind of Aldous and Asimov and maybe even Ballard. Those early those covers from the 60s.
The favourite one we had when you were little was one amazing one, which was wanted posters for fictional baddies from sci-fi space.
Literally brilliant.
It was just like weird women with like six breasts who were purple with strange alien heads. And it was like, and what crimes they committed around the universe. I mean,
so
we were
good.
Obsessed with that.
Yeah, I remember there was like a butterfly which had human eyes on the wings with a blade kind of stem. Yeah, that always really sort of stuck with me.
It's giving me the willies.
But it was quite scary, but maybe that's quite interesting, isn't
it? Yeah, I think, know. Yeah. It's kind of, I always feel like I need to balance out things with a slightly dark, weird edge.
Yeah, that's good. Balance it out. And tell us about some of the prints, some of the work that you've done with Super Collider.
So,
what's happened?
Yeah, so we've, Chris had interviewed me in 2011 about a show I had at Alternate Dimensions, which was at the B Store on Savile Row. I had a solo show there and a window display that I made. So he had interviewed me a while back and we sort of recently been discussing a collaboration, and he had to downsize. They had a big library of vintage science books, and he had to downsize. And he was.
Did the Gavin sisters weigh in and steal them?
Well, yes, this is what happened, but not. It was his suggestion. He basically.
She didn't make him give them to her.
Yeah. So he offered to donate a big pile to me, and then came up with the idea of me creating a series of works inspired, or using the materials. So. That's what I did, and we've just made them into a series of three print editions that they're selling on their site, which basically just launched. So it's a really nice way of tying it all in.
It's a super thing, and it sounds exactly up to the standards of what Super Collider was kind of invented in order to do as well, even if it is clearing out the library.
Yeah.
That's okay too, right? We're going to head off for our fourth of four trips into the unknown. Francesca, what have you chosen?
Well, it hasn't actually come out yet. This is a book that's about to be released by a friend of mine in Berlin called Karl Koblitz, who used to live in London. He's worked with Mario Testino. He worked with Wolfgang Tillmans for a very long period of time. And Karl basically is coming up with incredible ideas for books. And this book is about a subject that would never have interested me otherwise. And it's really brilliant. It's called Entryways of Milan. And basically he spent a good number of years going around Milan and looking at literally the doorways and small entrance spaces within the city. And it's amazing. It's like he goes through, it's largely a photographic book. It's published by Taschen. And it shows you doors, stairwells, and he goes into incredible details with the captions, telling you every single kind of marble, who designed every single light fixture and architectural element within there, as well as the architects on top of it. And for me, what I found so fascinating, A, it's like a dream, weird, nerd version of traveling into spaces you wouldn't normally see. I love the hidden, but they're just beautiful. It also reminds me of my favorite film, which is The Conformists by Bertolucci.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing stuff. All these places. So the idea for the book is incredible. The interiors themselves are fantastic, beautiful deco, kind of fin de siècle. Well, most of them are modernist, I suppose.
It's all from 1920s to 70s.
Yeah, and there is so much care and attention and expense unspared on rooms that no one will spend any amount of time in. You only pass through. And I think there's something wonderful, poetic, wasteful and beautiful about that.
I know. And maybe this is sort of a defining thing of what makes Milan, Milan, like, which is the home of Italian design in that sense. It's like so much detail, so much love. And also they're incredibly good condition. Like the quality of this is incredible. I think there's 140 entranceways in here. But it's just like the amount of like care and love and beauty into all of that. And also, what does that say about this interim space? We never really think about the entranceways of a place. I'd love to see like a series, the entranceways of Japan or whatever.
Yeah.
The idea of extending this kind of mid non-spaces, I find really, really fascinating.
Yeah, there is something about, there is something about that non-space, which is, but somehow sets you up for the room, the apartment, the evening or day you're about to have, right?
Well, it's like a curtain before the theatre begins.
Yeah.
It's like literally before the play started, the curtains are turning and this is the beginning of the stage. It's setting the narrative for your experience.
In terms of materials, in terms of the atmosphere of some of these entryways, Francesca, what did you find bewitching and beguiling about them? The warmth or coldness or what?
I mean,
was it
it's
about
really
them?
Weird, I can't believe I'm saying it, but the more fascist it gets, the more stunning it gets.
Yes.
I mean, I love the, as I say, I love the conformist, and I think the art direction, that's incredible, capturing how architecture can reflect political ideology. And this is very much like a recreation of Italy as the pinnacle, like of a Roman capital. So it's a 1930s version of an ancient Roman ideal. And I think the ones that get really deco, I just, they make me melt.
Yeah.
There's something about the, I love a curve. A marble curve.
And these are all in quite, these aren't in, these are in kind of quite brutalist, what we might call brutalist buildings. I mean, Milan was the only modernist, obviously, the second font of civilization, I suppose. There was none of it in Rome. There was very little of it in Rome, in Naples, a bit of it in Turin, but it's Milan, isn't it? That's the place where all this stuff lurks rather beautifully under the surface.
Well, it's a city I don't know that well. I've only ever been for the Fondazione Prada, which is one of the best museums in the world. So for me, it's very intriguing. But also you really can feel like that level of research involved in this. I'm sure this is just a small, tiny fraction of the amount of places that were discovered by on foot by Karl Koblitz, literally going through the city. And he comes from another kind of brutalist city. He was originally from Berlin back before the wall had dropped. So I had grown up just near Alexanderplatz in that kind of brutalist environment.
That'll do it for you,
won't it? Yeah, well, it'll definitely make you look at modernist architecture in a really different way.
And in terms, and this is to both of you as self-confessed sort of book junkies as well, this is such a specific idea. This is such a narrow idea for a book, so beautifully executed. Is that kind of what gets you going? That kind of thing of God, this is so specific. Someone's done a book about this. I have to know about it. I have to leave the shop with it.
Well,
Sean, do you know what I mean?
You must know
what Francesca means with this.
Yeah, I think Fran comes from a different angle because she's more maybe wanting to gain the knowledge and the background, because having come from an art history background, whereas for me, my visual library is just like for inspiration and references. So I kind of, it's really terrible. But
so you're ripping the pages out of the book.
Well, not those ones.
Saying,
no,
leave it alone.
No. I have a separate library of books that I don't touch and then ones that I use for material. But for me, I admit that I probably haven't read a lot of them, but I still
maybe
use them.
Maybe that gives you a really different, interesting take on it, because it gives more space for you to interpret narrative and something.
Yeah.
But which he's right. I come from more of an art historical background where I'm really trying to like squeeze the juice out of meaning within something.
And I suppose, and you, there is a way of reading the photographs of these interiors and the interiors themselves as you say, it could be fascistic, it could be brutal, it could be deco. It's certainly modernist in some way. There is something, you kind of want to read those pictures. You want to solve the puzzle, whereas maybe Shauna just wants to revel in it.
Obviously, I also love looking at work. I'm not going to say I don't. There's some books
you are
that
visual,
I have.
You're a visual person.
I mean, I have a lot of art books. I haven't read them all. Of course not. But I think that you're right. I think it would give me a different pull into what I'm going for. Also, I'm like a lot more interested in relationship to, like, say, screen culture than Shauna would be. Shauna goes for much more anthropological. But I definitely think, I don't normally go for a book like this. It's not my subject in a way. No. I'm not really that fascinated. If I was into design, I'd be going for graphics. I'd love Saul Bass or whatever, or like kind of art direction and magazine culture. So I've never really been desperately drawn towards the architectural. I often found it quite difficult to enter. But interestingly, I found it kind of hard to enter literally. So in a way, this is a great like stepping stone into entryways.
I don't think I could sum it up any better than that. Or more strangely, I think it's perfect. I think we've tackled our four subjects with equality, equanimity, no little amount of style.
Thank you both
very much indeed. Indeed. Shauna and Francesca, thank you so much
for
getting on famously in the studio thought you would, but also for bringing in something old and something new.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Culture. My producers were the Sisterhood, Holly Fisher and Bill Lutie themselves. Join me again at the same time next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thanks for tuning in.